from the four corners of Southern California. This is The Hot Seat, and you're in it with me, Max Schwartz. It starts right now. Today, as my in-booth guest, I have author of Days of Fire, Bush and Cheney in the White House, and the New York Times' chief White House correspondent, Peter Baker. How are you, Mr. Baker? Thank you very much for taking the time out of your schedule at USC and your book tour to come and sit in with us.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. The Hot Seat is very lucky to have Mr. Baker on the show and appreciates the time you will spend with us. So without further ado, let's get started. So what inspired you to write this book and how long did it actually take?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I covered the Bush White House for the Washington Post and later the New York Times. And the one thing I found is that reporters in the moment, I think we get about 10% or 20% of what's really going on. Mm-hmm. And only when you get a chance to go back later to do a book project like this do you discover a lot more of what was happening behind the scenes. And I think what you get out of revisiting the Bush-Cheney White House years is a surprising story of a partnership that people thought they understood but didn't really.
Okay. And how is your book tour going? And would you mind explaining, or not explaining, but what's your next stop? And have you decided whether you're going to write a book on the Obama-Biden White House?
That's a great question. Now, I am in the middle of a book tour. I've got 20 or 22 cities. I head next to Houston, and from there, Cleveland, and to my alma mater, Oberlin College, from there. And it's going well. I've had a lot of great questions, great interest, meeting a lot of fun people and having a lot of great experiences like this. So is there an Obama-Biden book to be done? Maybe. But I think it's better to wait until the administration is done than try to write about it when the train is still moving down the track.
Okay. And you talk about journalists not knowing everything about what's happening while they're covering the president. And I think that with Obama, that's been a key theme because a lot of things have been closed press or off the record. And the White House Correspondents Association has actually gotten frustrated with the Obama administration. So would you say that that's more so the case with Obama than other presidents, or the way Obama's treating the press?
Well, I mean, in some aspects, certainly. My colleague David Sanger said recently in a report, he said this is the most closed, control-freak administration he had covered. I think there's something to that. I think that they engage on other levels, though, and I think that they can participate in it depending on the story and depending on what they think are their own interests involved.
To me, though, Obama ran on the candidate of change, and it seemed like he was being open and accessible to the American people, especially to the youth who rely so much on the digital age. But it seems like what he's doing with the press is sort of going against what he ran on in a way. Would you?
Well, I certainly believe he ought to have more press conferences, more opportunities for reporters to ask him questions. What they think they're doing, in effect, is trying to go around the press to some extent. Mm-hmm. If Reagan did that in his own way back in the 80s, Obama does it today through Twitter, through social media, through the website that they have, the White House website. And they think that they can get out an unfiltered message that way. But I think that you lose something without engaging more with the press. And this president doesn't like to do the quickie day-in, day-out kind of interactions and two or three questions at a time kind of pool events, we call them, that other presidents have mm-hmm. done in the past.
And Tavis Smiley, while he was at USC, said that Obama's going around the press corps, like you suggested, by going on Leno and other shows like mm-hmm. that. Would you say that that's in an effort to dodge the hard questions that he's purposely avoiding?
Well, that would be one way of looking at it, certainly. You're certainly going to get a different type of questioning. You know, some of these the late-night hosts actually can ask pretty good questions that do, in fact, get revealing answers. But it is, I think, an environment in which a president feels more comfortable and thinks he's going to reach an audience that's different than the audience he reaches through CNN or the New York Times.
Okay. And I want to go from that, and I want to go into your book now. And one thing I want to ask is, the big theme, it appears, and one thing that's been talked about on all the news stations, is the dynamic between President Bush and Vice President Cheney. What would you say the dynamic of that was? And you talked about it a little bit at the Students Talk Back Forum, but what was that relationship like and how did it change?
Right, exactly. I think everybody realizes, of course, that Vice President Cheney was, people say, and I think they're right, the most influential vice president ever. But I think it overstates it when people think that he's there for the puppet master. There's no question that Bush was open and gave a lot of authority to Cheney in the early days, but the relationship then changed over time, particularly as Iraq went bad and Bush headed into a second term looking for ways to salvage a bad war and reshape his legacy. He began moving in a different direction on diplomacy, on some of the terrorism policies. Cheney, by the contrast, viewed these changes with alarm and thought they were going in the wrong direction.
And staying on the note of Cheney, there was a whole contest, as described in your book and as Carly Rose talked about, of getting to be Bush's vice president, and ultimately it was his decision. Do you think he purposely found flaws in all the candidates so he could be vice president?
That is definitely a suspicion that a lot of people have, including some of the other candidates for vice president. He's, as the head of the selection committee, vetted all the other possible candidates so that he knew their weaknesses, he knew their personal details, he had boxes of crates of personal information about them. And then when Bush came along and asked Cheney to do it, he didn't go through the same sort of vetting process. Having said that, you know, President Bush did first ask what became Vice President Cheney in March of 2000 through his aide, Joe Albaugh, whether he would be vice president. And Cheney said no at that time. So Cheney's answer to these critics is often, look, if I wanted to be vice president, I simply would have said yes at the beginning.
Do you believe that, or do you think he was just playing hardball?
Well, I think he changed his view of the vice presidency as he went along. He had been there in the Ford White House and helped marginalize and ultimately dump from the ticket Nelson Rockefeller, who was the vice president under Ford. He thought that President Bush, the senior, 41, should have dumped Dan Quayle. He thought being vice president was, as he put it, a pretty cruddy job. And I think ultimately he became convinced that Bush was going to give him more authority, that because he was not particularly seasoned at national security, that Cheney himself would have more of a free hand to have more influence than he might have had as a typical, formalities kind of vice president.
Do you think that he was dead set on becoming president? And you kind of just touched on that, but vice president, do you think he was dead set on eventually achieving that goal?
No, I don't think so. I think this is something that didn't actually appeal to him for a while. And it was, I think what it became appealing was it was a way of exercising power, influence, shaping events, and pursuing the issues he wanted without having to go through the rigors of a full-on presidential campaign the way Bush had gone through the primaries and so on. He only had to have 2 months of campaigning as a vice presidential ticket.
And staying on the topic of the Bush-Cheney presidency, Iraq was a deciding moment in terms of the court of public opinion. Would you say that Cheney and or Bush was set on invading Iraq and 9/11 was just the justification?
You know, it's interesting. We think about that, and a lot of people wonder. Certainly, Iraq was front and center in their list of threats they saw around the world when they came into office. No question about that. But I found an oral history that Cheney gave, in 2000, just months before he joined the ticket. And it wasn't released. It was kept secret until after he left office in 2009. And in the oral history, he was asked about the Gulf War in 1991 when he was defense secretary and why they didn't go further. Why didn't they go from Kuwait all the way to Baghdad and depose Saddam Hussein? And he said then in 2000 it would have been a mistake. They would have set off all these sectarian tensions. They would have owned Iraq. It would have been a messy thing, a quagmire, and they made the right decision not doing that. So even a year before 9/11, in this oral history, which never was released, something, therefore he wasn't doing for public opinion, he was talking about how it would have been a mistake to do that. And after 9/11, obviously, he came to a different conclusion.
So essentially 9/11 was the catalyst to invade.
I think so. I think, look, they were definitely focused on Iraq, no question. They saw Saddam Hussein as a danger. They wanted to turn the screws. They wanted regime change. They weren't necessarily going to commit American troops on the ground to it until 9/11 came along and kind of changed the environment.
Do you think that want for a regime change was because of Bush 1?
Well, Bush, the younger Bush, Bush 43, did say both in private and once or twice in public that, this is a guy who tried to kill my dad. Clearly, there was a personal element there in it for him. But I don't think that was the only thing. I think that's obviously a context in which he made this decision. I think they thought Saddam Hussein represented a danger to the United States, and a man like him who had, they thought, weapons of mass destruction at a time when 9/11 has shown how badly we could be damaged by 19 guys with box cutters. It just became what they thought was an intolerable situation.
And one more question before we move into the Obama administration, and this is going to be a short answer because we're running short on time, more like a yes or no. Do you think if it wasn't for his diseased heart, Cheney would have ran for president?
No, I don't think he would have. I think the thing that he didn't want to do was do the fundraising circuit and all the sort of chicken dinners and all the things that were required to become president.
Okay, so I want to move into the Obama administration now. And one thing that was talked about at the student talkback forum was Syria. Do you believe that Obama would have gone into Syria without congressional approval?
Once he decided to ask for congressional approval, I think at that point he was committed to following their decision. If he hadn't asked for it, then he might have still done it. But having said, I think Congress should weigh in on this. If the House or the Senate had said no, for him to then go ahead and launch a military strike, in the face of that negative vote, would have started an impeachment movement on the part of some people. I mean, not necessarily a successful one, but it would have just complicated the politics. And he would have had to explain why he asked Congress for its view in the first place if he wasn't going to listen to them.
Okay. And I'm glad you mentioned Congress. And I want to go back to 2008 when the Democrats ran the table by winning the presidency in both chambers of Congress. Do you think that given the blunders of the Republican Party and the Tea Party between their extremist wing, the government shutdown, and getting us to the edge of default without actually going into default, do you think that the Democrats could run the table again in 2014?
You know, anything is possible, but that's not the way the map looks right now. If you study the races, as other friends of mine do more carefully, race by race, the opportunities are still relatively narrow. There'd have to be a real wave kind of election to create that kind of change. And we're still a full year away. We don't know what will be the big issue when people go to the polls a year from now. It could be, as you say, the perception that the Tea Party has gone too far. It could be disgruntlement with the way the Obama health care program has worked. It could be something we haven't even thought of today.
So do you think that this will ultimately be played off as party politics?
The
shutdown and getting near default, or do you think that will be something voters remember?
Well, I think voters will remember it. The question is whether that's the decisive thing. If there is a continuing pattern of more conflicts like this, and we only kick the ball down the field 3 months, so it's certainly possible. If coming into the summer of 2014, you know, the dynamic seems the same, the gridlock seems the same, then that's a bigger factor probably in voter thinking. But it's a long road between here and the next election day.
Okay, and speaking of election day, we had one last night. Terry McAuliffe barely won the governor's race for the Commonwealth of Virginia. Do you think that race, given that he won in a purple state, granted it was mostly because of, well, not granted, but it was because of the suburbs turning more liberal, the Washington, D.C. suburbs turning more liberal, do you think that that's any indicator for 2014?
People like to look at those races and see patterns and see indicators going forward. And the truth is probably not. It is interesting in this regard. For the last 9 elections in Virginia for governor, I believe that number is right, the governor was elected was of the party opposite the party that had won the White House the year before. Mm-hmm. And this is the first break in that pattern in going back decades. So that's kind of interesting. And I think what the Democrats are going to take away from this election was they won because they beat Ken Cuccinelli, who they believe was a Tea Party extremist. What the Republicans might take away from the fact that Cuccinelli came closer than was expected was that they should run even harder on the health care program because he was seen as an opponent of that.
Yeah, that's the other question is, did he really win or did he just win because it's Cuccinelli? But then because the suburbs turned blue when they were purple, do you think that could be any indicator about other suburbs in a similar situation?
I do think the suburbs are changing. There's some interesting research that shows that suburbs for the first time in many decades are growing faster. The cities now are growing faster than suburbs, and suburbs are turning politically in a way that is going to have great ramifications for both parties going forward. Yeah.
Okay. And I've got one more set of questions on this time. It's on the NSA before we run out of time. Do you believe what Edward Snowden did was a good thing for this country?
Well, that's not for me to say. That's going to be for the, as you say, the court of public opinion and perhaps a court of law at some point if they ever actually do extradite him back here. I do think they were having a debate, though, mm-hmm. that's interesting. And I think that the newspapers believe in publishing stories about some of the things that he has released because we think that the public is entitled to know what its government is doing in many cases and to debate the proprieties of it.
Okay. And you're in the White House every day or almost every day covering for the New York Times. Do you believe that Obama didn't know the extent to which the NSA was spying?
That's a really good question. He says he didn't know that they were tapping Angela Merkel's phone, the Chancellor of Germany. What his aides say is that he was focused on surveillance very intently, but on the kind of surveillance of places where we have enemies, meaning places like Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen. And he wasn't focused on surveillance places like Germany because it didn't seem like a high priority, and therefore he never knew to ask the question. Having said that, that's a pretty interesting thing in the fifth year of a presidency to not know that you're tapping the phone of one of your top allies. You would think when you have a meeting with her coming up and they brief you in advance of that, something from those taps might have come into that briefing and it might have triggered some conversation that would have revealed the spying. And it makes you wonder who decided not to tell him and why.
Yeah, that's the thing. Do you believe that he wasn't, just because he didn't ask, do you think it was right that he wasn't told?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting to know. What we don't know from him is he angry about that? If there are things you don't know as a president and you don't want to know,
yeah,
and the things you don't know as president and you do want to know, and I'm not really clear that we know which of those two things it is with him.
And the NSA has said that our allies spy on us, and that's the excuse for this, but I highly doubt that France and England are tapping his personal BlackBerry. Do you buy that as a valid excuse for tapping Angela Merkel's cell phone?
Well, I mean, look, it's true. We've spied on allies going back many, many years. Henry Stimson, who was the Secretary of War and Secretary of State at various points, said, gentlemen, don't open each other's mail. But in fact, we've been trying to open our fellow gentlemen's mail for quite a long time. Having said that, I think you're right that if Americans knew that our president's phone was being tapped by the Germans, there would be great outrage about that. And the difference is that our technology happens to be better than their technology, and we are able to do things that they aren't able to do.
So are you saying you buy that excuse or you don't?
No, it's not for me to buy or not buy, yeah.
Okay. And one more question as a journalist. I promise this is my last one. Given what the NSA has done with the AP and trying to get involved with searching phone records, does this make you worried at all as a journalist about— one, doing your job, and two, talking to confidential sources and covering important government stories?
Yeah, I think it's on everybody's mind these days. A couple of my colleagues in the Bureau are knee-deep in these leak investigations. My colleague James Risen is at the Supreme Court trying to avoid having to be forced to disclose a confidential source. My colleague David Sanger's book is the subject of a large investigation by prosecutors. So it's definitely on our minds, and it's something we think about a lot. Now, most of the reporting I do as a matter of covering the White House is more political than classified. So it doesn't often involve, on a day-in, day-out basis, quite the same level of concern. But I think we're all thinking about that these days.
Okay. Thank you very much, for Mr. Baker, for joining me in the radio booth today. It was my pleasure to have you as a guest today, and it was great to have you on campus. The Hot Seat After Hours starts right now. You can email me at thehotseatwithmaxschwartz@gmail.com, or you can tweet me at MaxSchwartzTV. You can also read and follow my blog at maxschwartztv.blogspot.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you will join me next time. Have a great rest of the week.